dry air beyond, allowing the cloud to keep its fine edge. Much higher cirrus clouds are composed of ice, and the zone between the edge of the cloud and the air beyond is not so clearly delineated, which is why they tend to be blurry at the edges. For all the heft and fury of the occasional anvil-headed storm cloud, the average cloud is actually a benign and surprisingly insubstantial thing. A fluffy summer cumulus, several hundred yards to a side, may contain no more than 25 or 30 gallons of water. About enough to fill a bathtub, as James Treffel has noted. You can get some sense of the immaterial quality of clouds by strolling through fog, which is, after all, nothing more than a cloud that lacks the will to fly. To quote Treffel again, if you walk 100 yards through a typical fog, you will come into contact with only about half a cubic inch of water, not enough to give you a decent drink. In consequence, clouds are not great reservoirs of water. Only about 0.035% of the Earth's fresh water is floating around above us at any moment. Depending on where it falls, the prognosis for a water molecule varies widely. If it lands in fertile soil, it will be soaked up by plants or re-evaporated directly within hours or days. If it finds its way down to the groundwater, however, it may not see sunlight again for many years, thousands if it gets really deep. When you look at a lake, you are looking at a collection of molecules that have been there on average for about a decade. In the ocean, the residence time is thought to be more like 100 years. Altogether, about 60% of water molecules in a rainfall are returned to the atmosphere within a day or two. Once evaporated, they spend no more than a week or so, Drury says 12 days, in the sky, before falling again as rain. Evaporation is a swift process, as you can easily gauge by the fate of a puddle on a summer's day. Even something as large as the Mediterranean would dry out in 1,000 years if it were not continually replenished. Such an event occurred a little under 6 million years ago and provoked what is known to science as the Messinian salinity crisis. What happened was that continental movement closed the Strait of Gibraltar. As the Mediterranean dried, its evaporated contents fell as freshwater rain into other seas, mildly diluting their saltiness, indeed making them just dilute enough to freeze over larger areas than normal. The enlarged area of ice bounced back more of the sun's heat and pushed Earth into an ice age. So at least the theory goes. What is certainly true, as far as we can tell, is that a little change in the Earth's dynamics can have repercussions beyond our imagining. Such an event, as we shall see a little further on, may even have created us. Oceans are the real powerhouse of the planet's surface behavior. Indeed, meteorologists increasingly treat oceans and atmosphere as a single system, which is why we must give them a little of our attention here. Water is marvelous at holding and transporting heat. Every day, the Gulf Stream carries an amount of heat to Europe equivalent to the world's output of coal for 10 years, which is why Britain and Ireland have such mild winters compared with Canada and Russia. But water also warms slowly, which is why lakes and swimming pools are cold even on the hottest days. For that reason, there tends to be a lag in the official astronomical start of a season and the actual feeling that the season has started. So spring may officially start in the Northern Hemisphere in March, but it doesn't feel like it in most places until April at the very earliest. The oceans are not one uniform mass of water. Their differences in temperature, salinity, depth, density, and so on have huge effects on how they move heat around, which in turn affects climate. The Atlantic, for instance, is saltier than the Pacific, and a good thing too. The saltier water is, the denser it is, and dense water sinks. Without its extra burden of salt, the Atlantic currents would proceed up to the Arctic, warming the North Pole, but depriving Europe of all that kindly warmth. The main agent of heat transfer on Earth is what is known as thermohaline circulation, which originates in slow, deep currents far below the surface, a process first detected by the scientist adventurer Count von Rumford in 1797. What happens is that surface waters, as they get to the vicinity of Europe, grow dense and sink to great depths and begin a slow trip back to the southern hemisphere. When they reach Antarctica, they're caught up in the Antarctic circumpolar current, where they are driven onward into the Pacific. The process is very slow. It can take 1,500 years for water to travel from the North Atlantic to the mid-Pacific. But the volumes of heat and water they move are very considerable, and the influence on the climate is enormous. As for the question of how anyone could possibly figure out how long it takes a drop of water to get from one ocean to another, the answer is that scientists can measure compounds in the water like chlorofluorocarbons and work out how long it has been since they were last in the air. By comparing a lot of measurements from different depths and locations, they can reasonably chart the water's movement.